I'm here with one half of Hats Off to Laurel and Hardy, which is a show back on the Fringe. We've reviewed it before. We've interviewed Philip Hutchinson before. The other half, Tony Carpenter's off, currently doing his day job, but he's going to be up here for the Fringe show, which is taking place at Sweet Venues. Hats Off to Laurel and Hardy was a show we saw a couple of years back. And I just want to dive in and ask you a question, which is, most people won't know that Stan Laurel's only surviving child is still alive and very old, and you've just met her.
That's right. Yeah, it's Lois is his daughter. She was born in 1928. He did have a son called Stanley, but he only lived there for a few days. Lois has had a very long and involved life. And, yeah, we got flown out to Hollywood and we met her. And she met Lucky, our mascot, as well, who she went, "Oh, is that Laughing Gravy?" Which is, you know, the dog in one of their movies. And Lucky went straight in her face, went, "No, hello, my name is Lucky Dog, pleased to meet you," and almost gave her a coronary. But she was lovely. She was actually pleased to meet us, which was, it was bizarre, because you're looking at her and you're seeing half of Stan. It's very weird, very moving for us.
What do you think that Stan and Ollie would think of Sons of the Desert having so much life in the world now?
Oh, they'd be delighted. The Sons really just started off about the time that Stan died. It was being founded by people like Al Kilgore and John McCabe at the time. But Stan died before it really got up and running. And the idea, well, both Stan and Babe were delighted that they were getting airtime again when TV started re-showing their shorts in the 1950s. I think they'd be staggered that half a century after they died, you know, there's still people waving their flag.
And we've talked before about, you know, the timeless nature of their comedy. And yet, I was just doing an interview with some comedians here that the modern comedy mostly is very different from the idea of just having one or two cameras on the set and having to basically do theatre on film.
That's true. There's when they did this movie called The Hollywood Review of 1929, their entire 8-minute routine was one static shot. And people tend to notice that now. But the thing about Stan and Babe is that a lot of people, if they think about their comedy without knowing it, they think it's all slapstick pie throwing very fast, but it's not. The whole element of their comedy lies in massive long silences where nothing happens. And, yeah, comedy today just doesn't seem to have time for that.
Now, as a show that's been really well reviewed and highly reviewed and performed so many times, this is a kind of gentle plea for you to be as brutally honest and open as you can. This show's been on a journey and you've made changes to it. So, you know, what have you not been happy with that's led to changes, and what have you developed, you know, from the strengths that are there as well?
Oh, that's a lovely question, one that's really going to make me think. The thing that's changed from the start of it is that I'm someone who likes to video the performances, watch them back, and see how I'm appearing to an audience. Tony prefers not to do that so much, but we were quite quick in delivery at the start. We have to be, because it's a theatre show, and pauses that are too long all the time just makes it sound like it's dragging. Also, my Babe was very aggressive at the start. And you watch the movies, he's not aggressive. He only gets really annoyed when Stan really deserves it. So we've really brought that down. There's when we do it at the Fringe, I mean, yourself, another Fringe guru, for example, suggested that if you're doing a full-length theatre show, because it is usually a full-length show, you know, two halves and an interval, doesn't suit the Fringe so much. So this time for Edinburgh, we've actually cut this down to an hour-long performance. We've had to cut out a lot of the stuff we'd like to do, but we've kept in the stuff that's vital. So we've made them... we got more familiar with them as well. We knew them anyway, but the more we do this, we're meeting more of their fans, people that knew them. They're telling us tiny tidbits of information, and we retain that and put it into the performances. So they're much more gentle and rounded and real people than we were playing them to start with now.
And when we saw it in the second time in Brighton, you made the technical decision to bring control of them. There's some film in this and music and stuff. To bring it onto the stage, haven't you? You were activating that on stage.
That's right. Yeah, we have to keep that in, basically, because it saves us paying for an extra technician. We just have somebody doing the lights for us. All the sound and the video, there's lots of video clips we've recreated. We do that ourselves. We've moved the pedal now. We did have the pedal that operated the cues right at the front of the stage, and we realised recently, if you want to make something obvious to an audience, where better to put it in the front of the stage? So now it's upstage, and we hide it, and we just sort of like saunter over there, and the audience doesn't see it anymore.
Yeah, also, I mean, I've not seen that before, but somehow it... it brings the idea of this being a self-enclosed world even more into the fore, doesn't it? By not having such a clear, that's the technician doing it all, actually, it kind of, it made the show belong to Laurel and Hardy.
Oh, well, that's a lovely thing to say. No, we're just doing it for budgetary constraints, just to make it easier if we'd have to pay someone else. Yeah. But thank you for that. That's nice to know.
But I guess if there's a blip, you know, you're in character, aren't you?
Oh, God. Oh, yeah, we've had some blips. We've had a complete computer crash. We had to reboot the system. This is when we did Guildford Fringe last month, and we had a 10-minute gap. The entire system broke down, and we were improvising a 10-minute routine. Apparently, the audience thought it was all part of the show, because Tony and I know each other so well. We were just improvising for 10 minutes, and the audience were convinced it was scripted, it was meant to happen. And any time we've had a breakdown now, we hate it when it happens, but we look back on it, and the audience, you know, they actually almost prefer it to the script. Maybe not completely, that'd be really disappointing if it was the case. So we're not worried about those things happening.
But did you ever entertain the decision to, you know, have no technical stuff at all, just Laurel and Hardy on stage?
No. I never thought to do it without some sound or some AV, because I love putting them in. I'm fine for seeing theatre where there's nothing else there, but I do love some sound in the background. I love things to heighten yet another sense besides just retention and listening to someone's voice. And
so without making spoilers, you know, too obvious here, they were film, they weren't theatre. And so quite often I've seen at the Fringe people playing characters that were in film only in pure theatre. But you've decided, I guess, that to reproduce Laurel and Hardy, you've had to reproduce some of the film, haven't you?
Yeah, and we had great fun doing that. We would actually look at the length of each shot. We would take screenshots of every angle, and we would recreate that perfectly. Occasionally, we've even actually lip-synced the dialogue as well. If you do a film recreation on a stage, it's going to be a film recreation on the stage. But if you're watching, we try to make the clips fairly brief. They're not, you know, about a minute or so long each time. But if you're going to go and talk about a piece of their history, it's going to be better seeing it on film, for me, anyway.
If Laurel and Hardy's comedy is timeless and loved by generations to come, what's to stop the danger of you sitting here with me as old men saying, you know, you're going to do it another year, Philip?
Well, this is it. We don't know where we're going to give up on it. Every time we've done this, because, you know, it's been going a couple of years now, we try and look at some other angle we could take for Laurel and Hardy. We've already got something in mind for next year. And Jeffrey Holland, who's also, you know, doing the one-man show, This Is My Friend Mr. Laurel, he's spoken with us, and we're thinking of doing something together next year, one of their old stage shows. And we're trying to think of all the ways we can get of not losing Stan and Babe. It's not necessarily because we believe we have to keep on doing it, but because we don't want to lose them. We love being them, and we love talking to people about them. It's a mission for us to teach the world about the real people and not just these guys on a silver screen.
Something I've noticed, not from everybody, but from quite a few younger people, is within the people that love Laurel and Hardy and grew up with it, they share the disappointment that Stan and Babe had with their later films. But yet some younger people discovering things like Utopia for the first time, are actually, who don't have that baggage, actually quite like them.
It was the first Laurel and Hardy film that I saw. I wasn't actually a fan, and Tony said, I want to show you this film. It shows you how bad they were in their later years. Utopia, their final supposedly disastrous movie, has a lot of funny moments in it. The editing is really bad, but there's so many edits dependent on which edition of it you find. But there are some really funny routines in that. The thing that's so disappointing with their final movie is that Babe is just enormous, and Stan looks at death's door. He was really ill at the time. And so they both look really ill, and you feel for them in a script that often doesn't make sense. But they did much worse movies in Utopia. Just because you're a massive fan doesn't mean all their movies are good. Some of their movies are turkeys, but that's subjective.
So what do you do with the bad stuff compared to the good stuff? When you're mining this stuff, is this just territory you just don't go there? Or do you have to take it all?
We've not done recreations of films we haven't loved to bits. Well, the first thing they did together, The Lucky Dog, in 1921, it's not a great movie, but it's the first time they worked together, so we have to recreate that. And the routine we do is actually a funny and quite famous routine. But if we don't like the movie, it's not something we recreated on stage, because we've got to be passionate about the stuff we're doing. None of the movies that we don't like were necessarily vital to their career. Though we do mention the years they spent working for Fox between 1941 and 1945, they made some movies then that aren't very well respected. And we do cover them in some detail in the second half. Not in the Fringe version, though.
People may not know this, but I mean, you're not ever going to do a performance art version of Oliver Hardy in The Wizard of Oz that no one's ever seen.
Oh no, the Larry Seaman movie. Yeah, well, it was the one that it preceded Judy Garland. It's meant to be a terrible film. It's very weird. It's very dark. Laurel and Hardy fans will know about it, but I've had a copy for about 15 years. I've still not seen it myself yet.
But I mention that because, you know, a lot of people don't know that how many shorts they made that were silent, and how much of Stan Laurel's kind of silent career is there. Do you draw on that as well, or is it does this show come from when they started talking?
We do cover briefly that their careers, that we do their childhood, their upbringing, all that kind of stuff. Their film careers, we cover that in about 10 minutes before they actually meet, and we don't recreate any of the old film bits, because generally they were one reelers. They were shot very, very quickly. One reelers just means a 10-minute single reel of film at the time, and they were shot quickly with almost no plot. They improvised them on the spot, and consequently most of them aren't very good, and plus the fact most of them are lost. But their output was hugely prolific. Babe made well over 100 films before we even met Stan.
And that's all in the story. So if we dive into the bits that you love, that probably everyone else shares too, and you know, I'm not going to give away too much, but you know, some of the classics are there on stage and on film. What, if you had to capture it in a few phrases, is the essence of Laurel and Hardy?
Ah, great. Thought. It's going to take some editing, isn't it?
It's not going to be any editing.
Right. The listener may want somebody to go and make a cup of tea now whilst I think of the others. Affection. And silliness. Yeah, okay. That's probably it.
And wasn't there also, I mean, I guess I'm trying to derive this too, but Stan wanted the laughs, didn't he? He was absolutely fixated, and that's why he didn't like the later films, and you bring that up in the show too, that it's all focused on making us smile and laugh, isn't it?
Yeah, when Stan and Babe worked for Hal Roach, which is what most people remember them for, all the classic movies, Hal wanted control over their partnership, but he gave Stan almost all control over the work they did, the directing, the ideas. But then they moved to work for Fox. And obviously Fox is a massive corporation. Fox took away all their rights. Stan had no input at all. So all the timing he did, all the comedy, the relationship the two of them had, Fox had no idea about that. And they just made him just being two buffoons. Ollie was a bully. Stan was an idiot. And it broke it all down. There was no comedy timing anymore. They were just stooges in what were very B-category scripts. And obviously they didn't like that. Although they were still hugely successful, because Laurel and Hardy, people would just go and see anything they did.
So, I mean, what has playing Oliver Hardy brought out of Philip Hutchinson, the performer? How have you developed, and what skills has it woken up in you?
Me as an actor, it slows down my speech. As a human being, I have a very quick mode of speech. It's made me pace things out, do it slowly, and to learn that eyes can actually convey an awful lot. You don't have to use your entire body. If the audience is with you, a simple raise of an eyebrow can convey massive. Ollie Hardy is kabuki theatre.
But even now, as this plays again and again, are you still refining it?
Yeah, we do little bits now and again, but it tends to be organic. But there'll occasionally be a line we'd like to juxtapose words in it, or we'll find out there's a line doesn't fit, it jars, and we'll discuss it. We won't just do something without discussing it fully with the other. But yes, it's constantly ongoing.
Kind of in the psychiatrist chair question, I know you do other work too. I've seen one of your shows about Jack the Ripper. Is there a danger that this becomes, you know, a 10-year distraction from all the other stuff you were supposed to be doing?
It's not a danger, it's a reality. Laurel and Hardy's taken over my life. This show is my mission in life, to be Babe Hardy, with all the things that have come with it in this last year or so. The amazing good luck we've had, the way people have treated us, the way people react to us now, being Babe Hardy, it's almost like it was my destiny. And that sounds really corny, but I mean I found my place in life. And I think Tony could say that to an extent as well, being Stan. It just fits, and we're very comfortable doing what we do.
But if you could replicate yourself so that there's one guy doing this and the other guy's doing some new projects, you know, what's still there in the notebooks to be done?
My bucket list in life is mainly on visiting places. As far as an actor goes, we just want to carry on doing this. There's ideas for Lucky Dog. There's a theatre company, but they're all historically based. And, you know, I'm already forming the ones for them. They're going to be real, true life stories again. We got something planned for Brighton next year, and that'll be an hour-long one as well. So we're going to keep on doing it. We're going to keep this one if it has to be on a back burner, I don't think we're going to abandon it. We'll find that it's just a time when no one's going to want to book us anymore. And when that happens, we've done our last show, but we're not going to know about it till after it's happened.
But it sounds like, you know, talking to people like Jeffrey Holland, that what you've identified is not just a show, but you've identified two characters, and there's all kinds of things you could do with Laurel and Hardy.
Oh, I see. Yes, there's Tony's had this idea that he wants to recreate Hats Off, their famous lost movie, because all the script survived, masses of stills, and he wants us to actually do that, actually make the movie again. You could take Laurel and Hardy in lots of directions, but you end up then having the danger of being like the Larry Harmon cartoons from the 60s, where they started creating all these things that didn't really suit them. It would be more a case, anything we do now with Laurel and Hardy, it would have to be from work they've already done. We would actually stage things that they've done themselves. They did several stage shows. I don't think writing anything brand new for them would fit. It just wouldn't be right, and I don't think they'd like it either. We'd be basically using their faces to forward our own ideas.
Final question. You meet them. What would you say to Stan and Ollie?
Thank you.
Philip Hutchinson, thanks very much indeed.